From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the beating of a white motorist on an East Side Detroit street leads to difficult conversations about hate, racism, and crime.
Everybody is angry about this because this was something that was not explainable.
Plus, an Arab American community leader issues a challenge to the store owners who serve Detroit.
We need to recognize that Detroit is changing. And we need to change with it. We need to present something new.
We look at the chronic labor shortage posing challenges for Northern Michigan tourist destinations like the Grand Hotel.
He said, quite frankly, that if it wasn't for this dedicated group of people, we wouldn't have a hotel.
And making maple sugar in Michigan and why we should be making more of it. Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. A large number of the grocery stores, convenience stores, and gas stations in Detroit are owned by Arab and Chaldean Americans. And historically, the relationship between these store owners and the predominantly African American customers they serve has been tense and sometimes unsteady. But that is starting to change. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we hear from an Arab American community leader who's issuing a challenge to those store owners who work in Detroit. Also this hour, maple sugar season is well underway in Michigan. Maybe you don't know it, but our state ranks fifth in maple syrup production in the nation. And with the vast hardwood forest of the Upper Peninsula, Michigan's got the largest resource of sugar maples in the country. And that got us wondering, if we've got the trees, why aren't more people making the sweet stuff? But first, as the snow and ice have melted, Michigan has come up with a bumper crop of potholes and crumbling roads, roads that were already badly in need of repair. That has turned everyone's attention to fixing the roads and how to pay for it. State House Republicans are now proposing an annual $500 million solution. Here's one reaction to the plan. It's from Rich Studley, the president of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, which has been pushing for more road funding. He says a solution is long overdue.
We're now in a situation today where our state, Michigan, the state that put America on wheels, is now widely regarded as having the worst roads in the country. That is unacceptable.
Here to tell us more about the new road repair plan is Kathleen Gray of the Detroit Free Press Lansing Bureau. So what do House Republicans propose to do?
Well, they've got a proposal out there that is going to shift some things around and shift some tax revenues around and add about $500 million a year into the roads through 2018. Now, that's about half of what, even less than half, of what experts say is needed to fix the roads, but it's a start. And while road folks and business folks would like to see some more put into the roads, they at least are also saying, hey, this is a way to at least get the conversation started.
So I think everybody's big question is, well, where would $500 million come from? It has to come from something. Something would have to be cut, would it not?
Well, they're shifting some things around. What they're doing is the 19 cents that everyone pays on tax on a gallon of gas would end, and that would be replaced with a 6% tax on the wholesale fuel, and that might bring in some more revenues, but regular taxpayers wouldn't really feel the pain at the pump. And the other things that they would do is shift a portion of the use tax, which is a tax that's paid on out-of-state purchases, to roads. And that would generate about $230 million a year for that. The other part would be everybody pays 6% sales tax on purchases. Well, you're still going to pay the 6% sales tax on gas, and instead of that going to the general fund, that would go specifically for roads. Now, there are folks, especially like local communities, things like that, fear that shifting the use tax, shifting the sales tax, is going to impact them. And it could result in less money for local communities. And I think that that's where you're going to hear the most objection to this plan.
Because schools would be a part of this too, wouldn't they, Kathy?
Right, right. And, you know, so they fear that they just got some money back in revenue sharing through the budget and through the personal property tax plan that they've got, some money was shifted to make sure that communities are made whole. And now that they're made whole, that there's a fear out there that they're going to start losing money again.
Now, I would think that one element of this plan that's probably going to have pretty broad-based support is the fact that they want to increase permit fees on those great big trucks that are chewing up the roads.
Oh, yeah. I mean, those guys hardly pay anything now when they bring a truck that's way overweight. They have to pay an additional fee for these way overweight trucks and way oversized trucks. And so there would be an additional fee put on those trucks. But that amounts to $4.5 million a year in extra revenue. So that's not a whole lot. It might be something that the truckers are willing to pay in order that, you know, they aren't hit harder somewhere else.
What are we hearing from the Democrats?
You know, the Democrats are being pretty open-minded on it. They're saying that there are some elements of the plan that they really like, but they'd like to see more done also. It doesn't fix the whole. It doesn't fix the entire whole. The experts say that we need somewhere between $1.2 and $2 billion a year to get roads into really good shape. And this only gets us halfway.
And Governor Snyder, of course, as we know, asked for that $1.2 billion at the beginning of 2013. He didn't get anything. Lawmakers didn't do anything in 2013. So can I put a cynic's hat on and say, well, look, here we are. It's an election year. Oh, there's a plan.
It's definitely an election year plan because it doesn't involve any tax increase. And I think that lawmakers know that if they proposed some sort of significant tax increase to fix the roads, that they would run into some pushback back home. But they're also running into some major pushback from people who are paying $900 repair bills when they hit these massive potholes. So it's a real balancing act for them in terms of coming up with a solution that's going to fix the immediate problem and then also do some long-term things as well.
Now, are there any other plans that have been floated, although would they have a chance anyway, considering that this is the plan offered by the House Republicans who basically, you know, control the way things go in the House?
Well, there's still some plans that are kind of gurgling up right now in the Senate. There isn't anything specific that's been introduced yet, but I think that you'll see a competing plan from senators, and whether or not it has significant more revenue in it, that's a question that is going to be difficult because, again, it is an election year and nobody really wants to impose a big tax increase on taxpayers, even if it is for something like fixing badly needed fixes in the roads.
And what about a timetable? What should we be watching for, those of us who don't want to be paying that $900 for a blown rim and a blown tire because of a pothole? What do we watch for?
I think that you're going to see some pretty significant quick action on this plan before they go on their summer break. They're now in the midst of a three-week spring break. This is their second week of a three-week break. And then they'll go through the end of June, and they're hoping to get something done before then, because then they're basically gone for all of July, all of August, except for, you know, a day here, a day there, where they don't do any voting, but they're supposed to be there. And then they're back for a little bit, I think in September, but October and November they're gone too. So if they're going to have an impact, if they're going to get into this construction season, they've got to get something going pretty quickly.
Yeah, but it does sound like the question that still needs to be answered and answered clearly is, as we're shifting money around, if we shift to the roads, again, who might be hurt and what might be cut?
Absolutely. And again, you're gonna see local communities fighting back against this because they've gone through some serious revenue decreases. $6 billion in the last 10 years they've lost in revenue sharing. And, you know, they just feel like they can't lose anymore. And they're the ones who are responsible for some of their local roads, so they need some of that money too. But they also have to weigh that against things like police and fire and garbage pickup and that type of thing. Those, you know, they're all very, very important priorities for communities.
Kathleen Gray, Detroit Free Press, Lansing Bureau, keeping an eye on that for us. And as you say, there might be some other things gurgling up from the Senate.
Yeah, I think so.
We will watch for that and have you post us on that when that happens. Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A Clinton Township tree trimmer is still in a medically induced coma today. He was beaten late last week by a mob on Detroit's east side after he'd stopped to help a child who had stepped into the path of his truck. Detroit police say Steve Utash was not at fault. He'd been obeying the speed limit. And after 10-year-old David Harris stepped out in front of Utash's pickup truck, he did the right thing. He got out to help the child. And that's when he was attacked by the mob, who beat him severely and robbed his truck.
From what I'm reading, I mean, I don't know the full story, and we won't until my dad wakes up, but they beat him for a little while, and then they let him go, and then they came back. So I'm not sure, you know, the aggression. I don't understand why they were so angry at him, and I don't understand any of it.
That was Steve Utash's daughter. We're joined now by Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. Rochelle, this attack and this story has brought about such intense reaction from journalists like yourself to people searching on social media largely for a way to just express their feelings and largely their outrage over what happened to this man. What are the predominant views that you're hearing as you talk with Detroiters and from people who live outside of Detroit?
The biggest thing is enough, just enough. I think that I've had to explain the term tipping point to people. You know, I've had a couple of folks to send me emails, and I've written two straight columns about this. Why do people care now? This has been happening. You know, there were people who set upon an elderly guy at a gas station, the people who beat that veteran. Mm-hmm. You know, no, this is not the first thing that has happened. But to have an instance where this guy, a father and grandfather and all-around good guy, sees that something has happened, does what he's supposed to, and gets out of the truck to go and help a child, and this is the reaction that greets him. Tipping point is when something has happened over and over to the point where you cannot this is the instance that we're not going to take it anymore.
And are you hearing that from both sides of 8 Mile, if I may?
I'm hearing it from everywhere. The piece that I did in the Free Press that people can read at freep.com was because when I looked at the website that his daughters had put up to raise money for his medical bills, and so many of their donations and kind words were from people who were African American. Mm-hmm. And when I was talking to people, everybody I know, and when I say everybody, I mean to a person that I know that I've spoken to, is equally outraged. So this was not something that some people were upset over here and other people were making excuses over here. Everybody is angry about this because this was something that was not explainable.
Mayor Mike Duggan called this in his statement, he called it a vigilante action, but many others call this a hate crime.
It's absolutely a hate crime. What vigilante? I mean, if he had been trying to get away and they had chased his truck and stopped him and pulled him out because he had hit this kid and didn't do anything about it, that's vigilante. When somebody is going over to help a child, who in his eyes he sees a child, and a bunch of people grab him and hit him about the head to the point where the nurse who came to help him said it was the biggest gash in a head that she'd ever seen, and she's a nurse. Who does that? Mm-hmm. Why would you do something like that? You're not doing anything to say we're sorry you hit this kid. And when you go and rob his truck, that's not vigilantism. No, this was nothing except a hate crime.
You spoke to an African-American man who had made a donation to help Utash's family with the bills. His name is Jerry Carr. And he told you he believes that Detroit needs a dialogue not between black and white people, but between black people and black people. What does he believe that dialogue should be, or what do you think it should be?
You know, Jerry Carr, and I've gotten to know him because of interviewing him, is one of the smartest people I know. His sons are quite brilliant and attended the best schools, you know, University Liggett and MIT. And he said the only time that his son, this brilliant son who had a perfect score, math score on the SAT, the only time he was ever called the N-word was in Detroit. Never had a problem in any of these other places. He said something is happening in Detroit that people need to deal with. And they need to deal with that before they try to make other people deal with anything. This whole dialogue that people have been trying to have for 60 years about race and, you know, what we're going to do between black and white, we really do have to deal with what's going on with black and black. And people know it. I mean, it's not a, it's like people whisper about it sometimes, but it's not a secret. And I think that at some point we have to figure out what's happening within that segment of population that we can do to make things better. before we start demanding that people see us all differently. I want people to look at me and see me. But I cannot pretend like maybe a dozen, 6 to 12 people who have the same color as me did something this heinous. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, is there something that I need to be doing to try and make sure that we don't raise any more people like that?
What kind of conversation do you feel that we need to be having because of this? There seems to be a lot of sentiment expressed that, look, racism runs both ways, that a lot of people are expressing, gee, Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton would have been on the first plane to be at the site of where that happened. Where's the outrage to what happened to Steve Utash?
I don't understand how people are missing the outrage. I mean, this website has raised over $100,000 in 3 days. People are speaking out against it across the country and across the city. But here's my big thing, and this is what I said to everybody, and there were just a few people, and they're all kind of nutty, who send me these messages. Well, where's your Jesse Jackson? Or where's, mm-hmm. I said, you know what? You're their biggest promoter. Why don't you call them? I never have.
I'm speaking with Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. And one of the things you wrote over the weekend about, and we know there have been two arrests as mm-hmm. we speak right now. And one of the things you wrote over the weekend about the mob who beat Steve Utash. And here's the quote. These men should be banned from living in Detroit when they're released from prison. What were you saying in that statement? Were you saying just let some other city deal with them once they get out of prison?
So, you know, that's the shame of what happened when Coleman Young said, I want the criminals to hit 8 Mile.
Yeah.
He wasn't saying, I'm inviting you to go to Oakland County. He was saying, we don't want you here. Nobody wants them there. So I want them as isolated from any good community. I'm not sending them anyplace else. I'm saying that's not what we can have in Detroit anymore. So you cannot live here and, you know, do these types of things. Detroit is struggling and climbing out of bankruptcy and out of negative perceptions and trying to become the city it can be. I want zero tolerance for BS. I want zero tolerance for hate. I want zero tolerance for and you know what? What I want is rather than somebody go, oh, she wants to send them here. No, you say the same thing. You're not welcome here either. And pretty soon people who are capable of this type of violence will get the idea that you better go find an island somewhere away from humanity and go and stay there because nobody who is civil and who loves people and who has kids wants you around us.
Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley. As always, thanks, Rochelle.
Thank you.
A neighborhood church in Metro Detroit has closed its doors after 91 years. St. Henry's was founded in Detroit in 1923. Later that year, the church relocated one town over to Lincoln Park. In the 1960s and 70s, it had 2,200 families in its parish. But recently, attendance dropped to fewer than 500 families. Stateside's Kyle Norris's family grew up attending St. Henry's, and she went to the church's last Mass.
Inside of this church, it feels like a reunion. Frank Grisbeck is giving out bear hugs. He leans over to one woman and says, "Sweetie, how are you?" Grisbeck is a big guy. He's originally from Lincoln Park.
Believe it or not, Grisbeck isn't really pronounced Grisbeck, it's pronounced Jebek. And in this neighborhood, most of the people were Polish. Growing up, we came to St. Henry's.
He teaches history at Kalamazoo Valley Community College, and he drove across the state today to his old hometown to say goodbye to St. Henry's.
So it's a working-class neighborhood. These guys, everybody in these neighborhoods have worked for a bazillion years, probably for Great Lakes Steel or Ford's or somebody. As they're retiring, they're moving out, and I think that's kind of where the fate of St. Henry's went. You know, now it's time for another generation of folks to come in.
But they're not. Catholic churches have been closing for decades because of poor attendance and other issues, and St. Henry's is now one of them. It's consolidating with another Catholic church on the other side of town. Grisbeck says when a church closes, what you lose is a sense of history.
We're going to lose almost like an old friend, somebody that looked over the neighborhood, somebody that cared about the neighborhood and the people in it, and she's going to be gone. St. Henry's is going to be gone.
And today, the inside of the church is packed. People sitting in pews are lit up by a warm, buttery light. It's filtering in through a giant stained glass window.
That's probably 60 feet high at its peak, and it's in the shape of a house.
That's my aunt, Paige Kovac.
The colors in it are blues and purples and reds and golds and orange and greens. I mean, all the colors of the rainbow in it.
She says the window is one of the most picturesque she's ever seen in her life. She traveled all the way from Maryland to come to this last service.
I don't have my parents home anymore. this was a staple of my childhood. Both of my parents were buried out of this church. It's a significant piece of my life.
When a church closes, or at least when this church closed, they literally took all the most important objects, like the crucifix and marriage registry and the holy oils, and walked them out the door. We were sitting in the back with my aunt on my left and my parents on my right.
They're removing the crucifix, the large crucifix from the church. It's probably, I don't know, 12 feet by 6 feet with a figure of the crucified Jesus on it.
Four men carried out the crucifix, including parish council member Jim Boomy. He said it weighed a couple hundred pounds. Boomy said carrying the crucifix out the door was so final.
I was looking at the parishioners, looking at us, I guess, carrying it out, and I don't think there was too many dry eyes in the whole church, so I was just very emotional.
After the items were walked out, the priests closed and locked the doors. Frank Grisbeck says that ending was perfect.
It was very simple. The priest just sealed the door and left the church. And that was all. So now we have a shell in the memories, a shell in the memory of St. Henry's.
Since 2006, the Archdiocese of Detroit has closed or merged 65 parishes in Metro Detroit, and more closings are expected. I'm Kyle Norris, Michigan Radio News.
The first farm crop to be harvested each year in Michigan is ready. Michigan ranks number 5 in annual maple syrup production. And according to the Michigan Maple Syrup Association, that sweet stuff helps pump nearly $2.5 million into Michigan's economy every year. But there are lots of maple trees in Michigan that are not being tapped. And we wondered, if we've got all these trees, why aren't more people making maple syrup? Michael Farrell's book is called The Sugar Maker's Companion, an integrated approach to producing syrup from maple, birch, and walnut trees. Michael Farrell, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So take us back. How long has it been that people have been collecting and tapping maple trees and getting the sap and making syrup?
Well, the Native Americans were doing it before we arrived here. So it's been many, many centuries. And about 150 years ago is when we peaked in maple syrup production here in the U.S. We actually made a lot more back in the 1850s and 60s than we do today.
You know, it's interesting. I grew up reading the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder, and still to this day, very, very vivid about when it was maple syrup time in the big woods in Wisconsin and what they went into. And I can remember seeing or hearing her, reading her describing pouring the syrup on fresh snow and how good that was.
Oh, yeah. Maple sugar on snow is one of those, you know, spring delicacies. The hot syrup right onto the snow, it turns into a taffy-like substance, which is everybody loves.
Oh, sounded great. Why did it peak and then drop because other sweeteners came in, corn or?
Yeah, for many reasons. You know, in the mid-1800s, remember, the North didn't like the South too much, and they said that they weren't going to take any slave sugar, they called it, out of the South. And so people produced maple sugar as their staple source of sugar here in the Northeast at that time, and, you know, there weren't that many maple trees on the landscape, but there were a lot of farmers on the landscape, and almost all the trees were tapped. Those are the trees that people saved. You know, when they were clearing the land for agriculture, they saved the maple sugar bushes and used that as their source of sugar. So it was partly out of necessity, partly out of choice. You know, now today we're seeing another resurgence in maple syrup production. The industry is just about doubled here in the U.S. over the last 5 years and is poised for further growth.
And in your book, you write that Michigan's got one of the lowest utilization rates with the greatest potential for growth. I saw from the Michigan Maple Syrup Association, our average production is about 90,000 gallons a year. But what could it be?
It's about one of every 500 trees is being utilized for maple syrup production now. That's in far contrast to the way it used to be. And so, you know, if Michigan were to, you know, increase that rate of tapping, of course they could produce a lot more syrup and, you know, be selling a lot more syrup to all the people throughout Michigan and beyond so that people can start consuming more maple syrup as well.
Mike, is the demand there to make increased production worthwhile?
Yeah, well, we've seen that the market is growing at about 5 to 10% per year. And as we put more effort into doing the marketing, we sell more maple. I mean, it's almost as simple as that. You just have to go out and do the investments in marketing and promotion so that people understand what it is and know the difference between the pure and the artificial stuff. And when they do, they're willing to pay the extra price for it because it's healthier and tastes better and local, sustainable, all those good things.
Michael, can anyone tap a tree and make syrup? Is it a tough thing to do?
I wouldn't say everybody can do it because you need to have the right equipment. Well, first of all, you have to have maple trees or birch or walnut, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. And you have to have the right equipment to boil it down into syrup. If you try to do it inside on your kitchen stove or on your gas grill outside, you can do it. It's just very difficult. And to do it right, you're probably going to make some mistakes. So, you know, for people who just have maybe a couple trees, I still recommend tapping the trees. But instead of trying to boil the sap down into syrup, one of the best things to do is to drink that sap fresh. It's an excellent beverage. Or use it for cooking. We make our rice, stews, oatmeal, coffee, tea, all that kind of stuff with it.
What does it taste like?
It tastes like water with just a little bit of sugar. And
really?
It's got a lot of minerals in it as well. So it has it's got a unique flavor. And it's, that's all I drink during sugaring season. And it's one of those spring treats that few people know about today.
I would say not. When we talk about tapping trees for syrup, I think most of us, you know, we think maple. But as I was saying, I never knew you could get birch or walnut syrup. How does that syrup compare to the maple syrup that we do know?
Well, the birch syrup tastes much different than maple syrup. It's got more of a fruity molasses type of flavor to it. It's not meant for pancakes. It's more of a ingredient for cooking.
Mm.
The walnut syrup actually tastes surprisingly similar to maple. I mean, it's got its own unique nutty type of flavor, but it tastes very similar to maple, whereas birch is a completely different flavor.
You know, Michael Farrell, I read in the introduction, you were a guy headed for a career on Wall Street. So what hooked you on maple syrup and the maple industry?
Yeah, I decided I didn't want to do that.
I guess.
I went back to school for forestry. And in forestry school is where I learned about maple syrup. I never had it before going to forestry school. And when I got the chance to tour the college sugar bush and taste pure maple, I wanted to try it myself and got hooked then and been doing it ever since.
The book is The Sugar Maker's Companion, an integrated approach to producing syrup from maple, birch, and walnut trees, written by my guest, Michael Farrell. Pleasure to talk with you, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As we salute spring and bid a none-too-fond farewell to the snow and the sub-zero temps, you may well be making your plans to visit northern Michigan this summer. Well, that's where businesses like Mackinac Island's Grand Hotel or other resorts, golf courses, restaurants, and marinas are facing the challenge of a summer labor shortage. Ken Winter wrote about the issue recently for Dome Magazine. Ken, why is it such a problem for northern Michigan businesses like the Grand Hotel to find enough workers?
Well, I think owner Dan Musser put it quite aptly. There are only 492 people that live on Mackinac Island, and he needs nearly 700 workers. So he doesn't have a local labor pool and has to try to reach out as much as he can to the local labor pool in northern Michigan. But because of logistics, it's pretty difficult for him to always fill enough spots.
Logistics meaning trying to entice
to
people to move to the island for a few months out of the year.
He found himself having to always find places for people to live so they could work at the hotel because it just doesn't work, you know, going over on the ferries all the time. And even so, he was telling me recently that he put over $1.2 million in improvement for people to stay in places that he provides, and that still hasn't really ease the local labor problem. So he's had to, for a long time, reach out to the foreign market.
We see in your story for Dome that Dan Musser of the Grand Hotel actually works with a couple of visa programs to get foreign seasonal workers, and that sometimes people think that these programs are used to get cheap labor. But tell us how that is not true.
Well, the requirements for the visa program, particularly the ones that that aren't for students, require them to pay premium wages to get those people in addition to the money they have to pay themselves. Dan's large enough at the Grand Hotel that they use their own HR department to recruit these people to come up in from foreign countries to work. And in addition to that, he has to provide housing. And to be competitive, he pays a lot more to improve and have better housing than other resorts.
So what I'm hearing then is because of the with this visa program, he's actually paying more for those workers from foreign countries than he would if it was someone who came from Michigan.
Yes. You know, for the 300 additional people he has to find that he can't find, within the region, it's a very expensive program for him to operate.
So what do you feel, having talked to these people and having lived in the North Country for so long, what should they be doing to really attract and recruit these summer employees?
Well, I know there's some effort on part of the state to hold job fairs across the state a little bit, but I would think more emphasis to assist these seasonal workers, employment places, to bring up seasonal workers would certainly help. But Dan tells me, for example, like he's advertised in all the major newspapers or news outlets, websites across the state, and has worked closely with the state to bring people to his place. But that seems to be a perennial problem. There's another area that I came across. I had a friend that owns a landscaping business in Harbor Springs, and he finally gave up and has to just automatically every year hires 19 people from Mexico to come up to do work with this landscaping business because he can't find local people that want to do the work. And I found that too with other landscaping nursery operations across the north.
Which I find interesting when you realize that this was a problem through the Great Recession. So even, people who were living downstate and couldn't get jobs at home, they weren't willing to head up north for the summer?
No, apparently not. And that surprises me.
I think it's going to surprise really a lot of people when you think of this labor shortage throughout northern Michigan. Is there really a long-term solution, or are they just going to have to kind of keep limping by and trying to use these extra tactics to try to get foreign workers?
I don't see a change. And, of course, the Grand Hotel, unlike Boyne Resorts, that operates pretty much except for maybe April year-round, either skiing or for golf, or for some of the other recreational activities. The Grand has that unique situation where they basically open unofficially the last week in April, and then they close up the last day of October. They only have a short season. And I went to their 125th anniversary 2 years ago and happened to go a little early and watched Dan, his late father, then present awards to all the people that have come up seasonally for year after year, many of them more than 10 years. And he said, quite frankly, that if it wasn't for this dedicated group of people, we wouldn't have a hotel.
Well, that gives you pause to really consider, because that is really one of the crown jewels in Michigan's tourist crown, if you will.
And I think that they really treat their people extremely well. I mean, it's interesting. I've been going to that hotel now for 34 consecutive summers myself. And you get to know the people, and you realize that they're very happy. And they sort of consider themselves part of a family.
Ken Witter is the former editor and publisher of the Petoskey News Review, and his piece on Northern Michigan's domestic labor shortage appeared in Dome Magazine. And at the very least, Ken, you've got us thinking forward into the summer when we can be on Mackinac or be at Boyne and be on a golf course and not be tromping through snow. So this is all good.
Well, as always, it's a pleasure to be with you.
As the city of Detroit seeks pathways back to economic health, the entrepreneur, the small business owner, is seen as a key. And there can be no conversation about small business owners in Detroit without involving the Arab American and Chaldean American communities. Most of the grocery stores, convenience stores, and gas stations in Detroit are owned by Arab Americans and Chaldean Americans.
Historically, the relationship between these store owners and their largely African-American clientele has not been without its tensions. That's why a recent editorial in the Arab American News caught our eye, and we wanted to share its message with you. We're joined now by Osama Siblani, the publisher of the Arab American News. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Can you give us a sense of what you were saying in this editorial to Arab American store owners in Detroit?
Well, like you said in the introduction, that there has been tension between, you know, the merchants who happen to be Arabs or Chaldeans and the consumers who happen to be mostly African-American. We know that Detroit, 83 to 85% African-Americans. So, you know, the economic conditions of Detroit, the crime rate in Detroit that was very, very high. And at one time, it was like number one in the country in crime, you know, activities. So taking a risk and going into neighborhood and when working, doing the work that needs to be done in order to service the neighborhood, it's an honorable thing, and it's a good business thing. But, however, this relationship between the African community, African-American community, and the Arab-American community, you know, became tense when we started seeing more and more store owners and attendants dying, being killed, you know. And, of course, now the situation is changing in Detroit, and we're asking our community and the store owners in particular in Detroit to change also with the changes, to follow the changes or to accommodate those changes by making changes on the way they have been doing business.
In fact, I note in the editorial, here, I'm going to read a quote from the editorial. It says, despite deep Arab-American involvement in the small business economy of Detroit, for too long, the relationship between Arab-American store owners and their African-American customers has been defined by tension, mistrust, and suspicion. In this relationship, no party is innocent. That last line, why did that need to be said?
Well, because nobody is innocent in any relationship. Any tension in any relationship cannot be blamed on one side. It takes two people or two sides to create attention or to tango, like they say.
Sure.
I believe that the African-American community, you know, bears some responsibility, you know, in how the tension became, you know, more and more as we as the years went by. And also the Arab-American community, store owners in particular, they also bear the brunt of the relationship, bad relationship. And we said that in the editorial. We said that, you know, we Arab-American and Chaldean Americans, we need to do a lot of stuff in order to, you know, to fix this relationship. We need to treat our customers with respect. We need to open our stores and make sure that we do not buy or sell stolen goods. We do not want to create, you know, animosity between us and the customers. And we need to reinvest in the community that we're generating income from. And also, we need to treat them with respect and go to their churches, to their mosques, to talk to their sports teams, younger people, organizations, and try to get us involved with them. Because this is the way you protect your business, by dealing with people with respect and by servicing them, you know, and give them a good service. And now Detroit is changing. The big guys are coming back to Detroit, I mean, with the supermarkets, the big names like Whole Foods opened in June of 2013. Now other, you know, supermarkets are going to follow suit. And this is a major competition for those small owners who have really spent all their life, and sometimes they literally spent their life in order to protect their business in Detroit. Now they need to do something concrete in order to protect their business by start building relationship with the neighborhood that they serve.
It's a smart business decision, realizing, as you say, competition is coming now that Whole Foods has kind of kicked the door down.
It's not only the smart thing to do in business, it's the right thing to do.
The right thing. When we talk about this relationship, I have to say one of my vivid memories of a news story that I covered was the annual Memorial Mass at Mother of God Chaldean Church in Southfield. And it's the Mass in honor of the men and women killed in the past year at small businesses all around Detroit. And it was very, very heartbreaking to see the parents and spouses and children weeping as names were read out. These are people who were shot and robbed as they stood at their store counters or they were closing up for the night. So one can understand that in a city where violent crime rates are five times the national average, there will be tension and suspicion. But what I hear you're saying in this editorial is start at the very, very root in the beginning for the store owner reaching out to his or her customers.
I think with a smile, with some respect, with the, us being involved in the community that we serve, also building a relationship between the African American community leaderships and the Arab American leadership, which we're doing. We're very close with Reverend Anthony. We did actually an exclusive interview, an in-depth interview with the Reverend. We talked about all these issues, and also we need to do a little bit more. We need to educate the people who work in the gas stations and the party store.
Yes, you call for better training.
Training.
Yes, you talk about the training.
We need to train them how to deal with customers, especially most of them that they come immigrants. They don't know how to deal with this kind of situation, or they don't even know the customers that they're servicing.
Yes.
So it is our duty. We have to do some work. We have to change the way we're doing business in order to survive. And you're right about the heavy price that the Arab and Chaldeans have paid, for doing business in Detroit. 500 people have been killed, so far, on the duty, whether they're attendants or owners. And this week in the Arab American News, we have an in-detail article about those people who were killed, and we talk about how difficult it has been to do business in Detroit. So while we realize the danger of doing business in Detroit in the past and the mistakes that we made as merchants and the violence and the crime that has been committed against those merchants, we need to recognize that Detroit is changing, and we need to change with it. We need to present something new to our customers, to our community.
Yes, and I'm wondering, Mr. Sablani, what has been the reaction among the business owners to the column in the Arab and Chaldean business owners?
Well, those people who lost their life, of course, they say it's not fair, for you to blame us for this bad relationship, But also they understand that in order for us to continue to do business and improve our relationship as a community together, we need to revisit the way we've been doing business. Because the city is changing. We're being promised in here by a new mayor and a new team that the crime is going to decline, the business is going to be booming, other corporations are moving in, Detroit is recovering. So we need to be a part of the recovery, but we can't continue to do business the way we've been doing it before.
I know just from covering news in Southeast Michigan for so many years now that you have worked tirelessly for many, many years to create a greater understanding between the Arab American and Chaldean American communities and the rest of Michigan. And I'm wondering, when you think about your vision for the recovery of Detroit, what role do you hope these Arab American and Chaldean American business owners and their employees will play?
Well, if you take a look at what the Arab American community have done in East Dearborn, for example, on Warren Avenue, and how it turned a district into a vibrant district from dead, it was boarded like Livernois in Detroit, and it turned it into a very vibrant district where you can't find a place to lease or to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So Arab Americans also did the same in Detroit. They went into Detroit when everybody deserted Detroit, and they stayed there and they worked and they took the risk and they paid the heavy price for it. And I am saying today that if Detroit is recovering, part of this recovery should be, with the Arab American community moving in, not only working in Detroit, but living in Detroit, claiming back Detroit. All of us, Detroit means to us much more than a city in Michigan. It means an identity. When we're traveling overseas, they ask us, where are you from? We tell them we're from Michigan. They say, oh, Detroit? Mm. So Detroit is the place that we belong to. And we should not have deserted Detroit, living in Detroit. I'm talking not business only.
Right.
So I encourage our people to go back, live in Detroit. And we have a great community living in Warrendale here on the border of Detroit and Dearborn. We have a large, large Arab community, Iraqi community, and Yemeni community living in that area and Lebanese. But we encourage more development. Today, as Detroit recover, we need to be part of this recovery. We need to reinvest in Detroit. And I know Arab Americans are buying large numbers of buildings, and they are, you know, renovating buildings, and they're, you know, working in the recovery system, and they are helping Mike Duggan, the new mayor, to put Detroit back on its feet. So we are part of this recovery, and I am very thrilled that, you know, our relationship with the African-American community is improving. And if you can visit the article that the interview that we conducted with Reverend Anthony, he will attest to that. We have a long way to go, and we need to continue to improve this relationship and build bridges with the African-American community. But also we have other communities that we need to reach out in, and we need to form coalitions. And that's what we've done in the Arab American News, by forming a coalition with the Michigan Chronicle, the Michigan Citizen, the Latino Press, and the Korean Weekly, and also with the Jewish News.
Osama Sablani is the publisher of the Arab American News, and you can read the editorial and the other articles referenced in this interview by going to ArabAmericanNews.com. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside, Mr. Sablani.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tenniskitter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.